How'd you know I play poker?
I read minds.
Sure.
You look like maybe you might be a player someday.
Coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we talk with Michael John Lacusa. We also talk about Little Mermaid at Paper Mill, A Little Night Music at the Arden Theater Company in Philadelphia, Company at Signature Theater, The Guardsman at the Kennedy Center, and Gay Fest. Please stay tuned.
Do you play without fear? Do you throw one by? Or will you cry into your beer? Can you toss away a strong hand when you smell that you've been beat? Can you sit in your chair for a long time? Can you survive the heat? Can you count the cards, knowing when enough's enough? Can you gain her blood, little lady? Do you know when to bluff? When you know it all, loves Benedict, there's something.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway for Sunday, June 16th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks, which just came out. I encourage everybody to go out there and buy five or six copies. Please do.
One will do.
Alrighty. His columns appear at MTI, Critchaland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He's also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com and many other places around the internet. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
With us this evening, we have Michael John Lacusa. Michael John is an incredible writer that I'm a big fan of, and he has got a new cast recording out of Giant, which was in partnership with Ghostlike Records and the Public Theater. So, Michael John, tell us about the recording and the process and what was really involved with it.
Let me thank you very much for having me join you guys today. You know, I listen to your broadcast all the time. It's a great program, and listening to the you guys go on about theater, it's always so wonderful to listen to. I just wanted to let you know. And thank you very much for having me on board. Yes, Giant. We just released the cast album for it all, and it's a two CD set produced by Kurt Deutsch and Joel Moss and myself. And it's was a labor of love, and really excited to have it out there in the world.
So the cast that did it was the cast of The Public?
Yes, with Brian Darcy James, Kate Baldwin, Michelle Pock, John Dossett, Katie Thompson, a huge cast, 23, I think, in toto, and a 17-piece orchestra that sounds absolutely gorgeous with Bruce Coughlin and orchestrations and the wonderful Chris Fenwick, who is at the podium conducting it all. It's quite beautiful.
I don't imagine you had to fight to get it to be two CDs, did you?
Well, you know, it's interesting when, you know, it is a large show, and there was a dilemma. First and foremost, do people buy two CD sets anymore? I mean, do buy CDs anymore? And whether or not there was the money in place for it all, because it is a very expensive proposition these days. There's very little studio space. And of course, you know, the union costs and everything, and you have to really, really be on a very, very tight budget. And at one point, when we decided that we were going to record it, we had the money, and it seemed like we may only be able to do a highlights record.
Oh, really?
And I kind of fell in love with that idea because I grew up with the old LPs, you know, which 54 minutes, 60 minutes of music at tops, you know, and I kind of got into that idea about how would I tell this very, very large story in a sense, in the highlight sense. So I got kind of excited by it all, and then all of a sudden, a chunk of money was graciously handed to us, and we were able to put more on the album, and it was quite wonderful in that respect. So we were able to do the two CD set. So, but I do want to let you know, I was really excited about doing the highlights album. I remember South Pacific, remember, it's like only 55 minutes of music, I think, on that album. Peter, you probably know that better than
I. Oh, probably less than that.
Yeah, less
probably
than that.
Maybe less than that? Sure, oh, 45 yeah, minutes yeah. sometimes. Yeah.
yeah
and
yeah,
so I kind of got into that idea, you know, about, what would a highlights album be like? You know, how would I condense the story and have the listener be able to experience that show? you know, so it was kind of fun to put that idea together. But again, I'm so happy with the extra money and that we were able to put as much of the music as we could on the album without making too many sacrifices.
How did this project happen? Did you love the movie from day one? Did you know the novel? Who approached Tomb? How'd you get the rights?
Well, it was very fortuitous that Julie Gilbert, who's the niece of Edna Ferber, grandniece of Edna Ferber, came to me. Gosh, it would be back, around the turn of the century, folks. And she came to me and she said, I don't know if you're familiar with the novel that my aunt wrote, Giant. And I said, yes, I'd read it many, many years ago. I'd been familiar with the movie. And I read it, and she said, I think you'd be the right person to turn it into a musical. I was familiar with Marie Christine, I think, and Wild Party at the time. And I read it, and I came back to her, and I said, absolutely not. No.
Oh.
No. The 10,000 cattle. Texas guy. How do you do that? 25 years of a marriage. How do I do this? You know,
and no one is a Taylor.
And no one's good to agree with good, but dye gray hair. Yeah. You know, and I said, oh my goodness gracious. You know, I don't think so, Julie. And, but she was persistent. And about 5 years later, she did come back and she said, have you given it any more thought? And, I always say this to like my students, anybody, you know, the older you get, sometimes it's kind of interesting how you read a book or you see a movie or a play at one point in your life. And then later on, even 5 years difference, you're a different man and you see things and hear things and look at life a little differently. I guess it's mm-hmm. called getting older. Mm-hmm. You know, and I read it again and I saw something and I heard something in it that I thought, oh my gosh, I understand this now. I understand what she's talking about here in a much more profound, deep way and in a musical way because I was able to hear music, which is very important to hear when you're reading or looking into a new property. I knew I couldn't do it on my own, though. I had to have a collaborator with it because I wanted to make it as epic as the novel is. And I turned to my a good friend and a teacher, a co-teacher of mine at NYU, Sybil Pearson, and I said, would you like to collaborate with me on this piece called Giant? And gave her the book to read, and she came back to me and said, no, absolutely not. And again, she reread it, and she had a glimmer, and we talked about it, and then we literally held hands and drove off the deep end on it all. And plunged right into it. So
now, of course, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm done.
All right. Of course, when you had your tryout down in Virginia, the show was substantially longer.
It certainly was. Even before Virginia, when we did our first, workshop through a staged, not staged, but behind the, music stand kind of reading, it ran 5 hours and 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a long, but it was my intention to be that way. I mean, I think like once sometimes you go to theater and it it goes into the 3 hour mark and suddenly it becomes something a little bit more transcendent and it was three acts and but by the time we hit Virginia though we were able to cut a good hour out of it all. So our show down in Virginia ran about 4:20, I believe, down into the three acts and with two intermissions down there. And we thought when we were bringing it to New York, we thought, okay, well, we have this longer version of it all, the three-act version of it. What would we make of the show if we were to try to make it available for people with babies and with cars to park and, people that don't have 5 hours on their hands to go to the theater? How would we make fashion a show out of what we have already and what we'll always have? How would we make it into something that could be more, user-friendly, audience-friendly, people that, like I say, have families and who don't have the time to take out 5 hours of their life on and on, but do have the time to take out 3 hours. And so that's how we came about with our version for the public, which is edited and kind of down to 3 hours.
So in a way, this is a highlights disc.
It kind of is. I think you're absolutely right. It is the highlights of the highlights. Yeah, exactly right. And like I said, we have both versions of it, and I want to make both versions available. I like many of the cuts that we did make, though, and they would remain. Our Rodgers and Hammerstein Music Library is publishing the show and licensing it, so we're going, so we'll have the three-hour version that we did to the public available to people to do, as well as a longer version eventually.
By the way, I just got back from Signature in Arlington, seeing a very fine production of Company.
I heard it's good, yes.
Very good, yes.
Yeah, they do a great job down there. I loved working down there. I love Eric Schaefer's work down there. The space is fabulous to work in, and just a wonderful environment to develop things. And they're so devoted to the new musical stuff, as well as celebrating, you know, some of the great Sondheim and Kander Neb and everything. Do a really good job down there.
Now, the arc of the timeline here is that the Signature production was in 2009, was it? And then you have your...
I think it was 2009, yeah.
And then you had a production at the Dallas Theater Center as well, and then at the Public this year.
That's
so
right.
These musicals are taking a much much longer arc in development than, say, in the earlier days, in when Rodgers and Hammerstein would write a show a year. So how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that every show is different, and Giant is certainly a lot different than your usual musical. I mean, what we were trying for is, of course, an adaptation of what we had down there in Signature. So therefore, it demands a lot more attention, a lot more craftspersonship time going into that all, and we wanted to make sure that we had it as right as we possibly could, because you have to understand, one thing also, too, is that the expense of making a musical has gone up, and you have to be very cautious, and you have to be very careful about what you're spending your time and your money on. So, you know, yes, it was fine back then, but costs were not as high as they are now. So you want to be careful, and you want to be thoughtful about the process, and you don't want to indulge. Certainly, you don't want to indulge, you know, in time, but you work on it until it's ready, because otherwise you're spending money on something that's not ready, and that money is very hard to come by these days, and particularly for a piece like Giant, which is, you know, it has its esoteric value as well as its commercial value as well. It has its, you know, audience, but it's also, too, it's a different beast. So you have to be cautious and smart about how you use your development time. And I think that we were smart in taking these smaller steps, which, of course, added the time for it to arrive in New York. But at the same time, I thought were good steps to take.
Well, the Mexican songs are really quite pretty, too. How did you, do you have a native penchant for that type of music? Did you listen to a lot of albums? Anything special in the creation of those songs?
Yeah, I always do a lot of research about that. You know, for the vernacular, I find that, you know, for me, at least as a writer, I have to understand the vernacular of the period that a character's in, because we're all informed by the music that we hear around us on a day-to-day basis. So if Giant were set in, you know, 2013, there'd be rap, you know what I mean? It would have an infuse of that. So I think the vernacular is very, very important to immerse oneself in, I do at least. And it was great to, explore Mexican music. I had not written a lot of Mexican music before. I'd explored, flamenco with Bernarda Alba. I explored a lot of Latino music when we worked on Chronicle, and I've had Latino music in my shows. Tango I've had in my shows. But I never really actually had done Mexican folk music, so it was great exploration for myself. And I tell you, I did some of the crazy things. I remember there was this brilliant two-man mariachi band marching through the subway, destroying everybody's peace and quiet. But I loved them. I thought they were fabulous, and I would follow them car to car for the longest trip and forgot to get off them. When I stopped, I said, we've got to keep listening to these guys who are playing this stuff and figuring out how is that guitar working there, you know?
I love so many of the lyrics, especially when she talks about going to the opera as opposed to the Opry. That's a very clever lyric and certainly tells us a lot about her. And the lyric, too, about I want to go to one Met and then the other Met, too. So that's really quite skillful. Which do you enjoy writing more, musical lyrics?
Oh, I love both. I love both. And they go hand in hand for me, thank goodness. I also, you know, I write music for other lyricists when need be, or I'll just write lyrics if the job requires that. And I like to think that I can be flexible in both arenas. It's tough when you're doing triple threat stuff, though, because it's a very lonely thing without a collaborator. Like when I'm writing my own book and lyrics and music, it's a it's a lonely thing. You know, you come home and you argue with yourself, which is, you know, very schizophrenic to do. But, you know, the lyricist is yelling at the composer and the composer is yelling at the book writer, and it all happens to be one person. It's kind of weird. It's wonderful to have a collaborator there to share the joy of writing with, and also the heartache of it all, too, and the struggle for it all. So I much prefer to work with a collaborator when I have a chance to do that. Yeah, absolutely.
Talk about the recording again. You mentioned in passing that a lot of people today, of course, don't buy CDs. They download or whatever. But for whatever it's worth, I wanted to mention this: the CD set does have a beautiful booklet with all of the lyrics and lots of color photos of the production. Which I know a lot of booklets don't have those because of, I guess, for cost reasons or whatever, but however they worked it out, that's a wonderful thing. And I also was reminded again, it's so neat to me that the main image of the show for the logo is actually a photo of the wonderful actor Miguel Cervantes.
Miguel, yes.
Who played Angel Obregón, who I've known for years. I first saw him in a show in Boston, actually, and here he was in your show. But I thought it's so interesting that whomever decided that would be the central image of the show, since he's not technically the central character. But I think that it's also interesting that the first song in the show is the beautiful Aurelia Dolores, and then it's also the last song in the show. I guess it's really about the fact of it's as much about the Mexicans as it is about the, you know, Bick and Leslie and all those other people.
It is. Well, the thing that, I've always said about Giant, and why I love the public photo there with Miguel, darling Miguel, I think we have the status quo says you can only have this many lead characters in a musical. And I always felt that there were 9 or 10 or 23 major characters. There was no minor character in China because everybody is connected. It's like, you know, and we have that on our cable series. I mean, goodness knows. I mean, a series like The Sopranos doesn't have 5 main characters that have, you know, operating at any given time, 9 major characters, 10 major characters. You look at some of these great TV series that we have right now, some really brilliant writing. And I thought, you know, this is, you know, and that's true in the book too. There is no minor character. And I think that the poster said that, you know what I mean? That here's what you may think is a minor character, but he's not. He's major in so many ways. If you look deeper into the piece and you find that this, because of this one character here who's discovered by a baby by Leslie, Leslie changes her philosophy about Texas, which causes trouble in her marriage. And then the son of hers who encounters this young man and grows up with him as a friend, when he dies, he stands up to his father and says, "No, I'm not going to follow your way." So this, you know, there is no minor character. There's no minor character in any of our lives, and Giant says that, and the Ferber says that there is no such thing. We're all so important to each other in order to make us function well as a country.
On that note, this may sound like an insane question, but did it ever enter your mind to write a 2-part musical?
You know, Giant, I thought, you know, what if we did it over 3 nights? You know what I mean? It's, you know, sure, why not? I have a piece right now I'm looking at. I'm kind of going, wondering what producer I could, you know, convince to do it over 6 nights here or something like that, just for the, you know, the thing of it all. But, there's something about the adventure of it all that is rather exciting to me. I mean, one of my favorite pieces is the 7 Streets of the River Ota, which is was a Robert Lepage piece a couple of years back here in New York at BAM, which ran 8 hours. And it was so mesmerizing and so beautiful and so great. And, you know, the Ring cycle goes on forever, too. You know, it's 15 hours of music. So I say, you know, musicals can sustain that if they're interesting enough and your story is interesting enough and your music's compelling. You know, if you do it, you can do it right, you know.
Did you spend any time in Texas, much time in Texas? Had you been to Texas?
Oh, yeah. You know, because I worked an awful lot at the Houston Grand Opera, so I knew Texas, South Texas. Was familiar with Dallas because they've done my shows down there, and I've been invited down there. Love Austin. Austin's a great place to go for music and, of course, for food. If you love your barbecue, that's the place to go. And Corpus Christi is beautiful. The beaches there are absolutely spectacular. It's a country in of itself. It really is. Country within a country. And it's a fascinating place, and it was very, very interesting to meet and work with people who live and reside there. I've not had that opportunity to do that often, except, like I said, at the Opera House, which is a very rarefied experience. But working down there at the Dallas Theater Center was wonderful because that really was a chance to live in Dallas and work with the people there, and I loved it.
So tell us about, you talked about writing a multi-piece piece. What else is going on with you? I mean, you have a lot of irons in the fire right now.
I have a couple projects that are working on. I'm doing a new piece with Sybil Pearson. It's based on the Somerset Mom story, Rain. People probably know the Sadie Thompson movies. I think it was going way back to Norma Shearer, that silent that's lost to us now. But and then there was, I think Joan Crawford did one, and Rita Hayworth. Am I right about that? Rita Hayworth did one of the movie versions.
There was a musical way back when. Do you know about that?
I think so. Yeah. What was the name of that?
It was Sadie Thompson.
Yeah. Oh, right,
Ethel Merman was going to do it, and she didn't like it. She dropped out during rehearsals. June Havoc came in.
June Havoc. That's right, Peter. That's right. It was June Havoc. That's right.
It didn't quite work out. And there is a recording of that, by the way. And you understand why it didn't work out. So as a result, we'll leave it to you to get it right this time.
Well, I hope so. You know, we're looking forward to getting work on that. And I've written, I'm doing something very, very dangerous. I'm doing something called First Daughters Suite, which is sort of a return to the First Lady Suite that I had written many years ago. And I recognized by the time Giant had wrapped up, I said, oh gosh, I still have some more to say about my first ladies and their daughters. And I started writing that. So I'm going to do that for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival has commissioned that for me. So I'm getting that together for a reading in October here in New York. Working on that, and two other new projects, one with Graziella Danielle and my collaborator Ellen Fitzhugh, and then there's like three other ones out there that not sure what I want to do with yet, but getting them out there. So
keep yourself busy. Do you ever get a chance to revisit some of your older works?
I just came back from a wonderful place, Kansas City, where everything is up to date. It is Kansas City. And I'm telling you, I was blown away by this production that was done at the Spinning Tree Company. You know, there's a lot of, young people who, you know, have tried their hand at New York, got along here great, had success here, you know, they and their partner or their husband and wife or husband and wife, they are going back to their roots, going back to their hometowns, and they're creating theater companies. And the talent down there was so shockingly amazing because, you think, only in New York, but not really anymore. We're all connected to the internet now in a different way. Audiences, I think, are much more sophisticated out of town than they've ever been before. And, so I was just really thrilled by saying hello again down there at the Spinning Tree Company. They did a really, really terrific job of it all. And when I have the opportunity to see something that people have done, I'm always run and go and see it because it's fun to see how the show holds up and also to get to know the people that are interested in the work and to talk to them about the work afterwards. It's always enlightening to me, at least, a wonderful adventure to do that.
Well, it's always great to see... you back and doing great work and releases
thank
all about
you.
And lots of things to come from you. And we're all very excited. So thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday afternoon.
Thanks for having me tonight, guys. Have a great one, okay? Take good care of yourself.
You take care.
Thank you.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
So much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, You know, I was remiss. We were going to ask Michael John about his Tony, his contribution to the Tony Awards broadcast a couple weeks ago and his lyrics for the television segment that was very, very funny in the middle there.
The television sucks segment.
Yes, television sucks segment was very, very funny. So, oh well, we'll get him next time. But Michael, you got a chance to go see The Little Mermaid at Paper Mill. Please tell us about that. Is it the Disney version?
It is the new Disney version. It's a significantly reworked version of the show that was seen on Broadway. There are a couple of new songs and a couple of songs that were in that version that are no longer in it. The major difference, I'm happy to say, is I think many people felt, and I certainly felt, that the main problem with the Broadway production was the staging and the direction. And if you want to get more specific about it, the decision that was made to have a lot of the cast, all of the people really who are supposed to be mermaids and mermen and fish, on heelys, was the word that I'm told is used for it. That was the decision that was made, the concept that was made to get across the idea that they were swimming in the ocean. But it didn't really work. It just really did not work. So this production...
Let's stop for a second and explain what Healy is. I know what Healy is because I have children. A lot of people don't know what Healy is.
Well, I guess the old-fashioned term for it was a skateboard. Isn't that basically...
Well, a Healy, as far as I understand, is it's wheels built into your sneakers.
Glide.
Well, I think so that then... I think maybe that it was a combination of both. I think it was on Broadway that it was skates, but it was also people on like almost surfboards on wheels. So that's how I remember. But at any rate, it was people on skates in one form or another. And now that has been replaced almost completely with flying. Which really gets across the idea much more because you don't see people's legs hardly ever. And that's the basic point we're trying to get across. So you never see Ariel's legs. I mean, you see Finn's and she's flying or she's seated somewhere and you can't see her legs, you see a fin instead. And King Triton, flies around to indicate swimming. And I don't know how it sounds, but it really looks wonderful. It really gets the point across. And then also they do a neat little thing. This may sound silly again, but when they're standing talking to each other, the bottoms of their legs and feet are obscured by set pieces. And what they've instructed the cast to do is to kind of undulate their bodies very slightly, as if to indicate.
I thought that kid playing Flounder did it spectacularly well.
Oh yeah, yeah, he did, didn't he? Yes. And his name, for the record, is Christian Probst. I wasn't sure, and we actually saw him briefly afterwards. I think he's very young. If he's not a teenager, he must be close to it.
I agree.
On Broadway, Flounder was played by a pre-adolescent, and very well, I might add. But that's another one of the changes in this version. They've reworked the story a little bit so that Flounder... now is older, and he actually has this sort of unrequited crush on Ariel, which I thought was kind of sweet. There are other elements of the story that I that they added from the film that I still think maybe aren't really necessary and don't really work and maybe complicate things a little bit too much. All of this backstory about Ursula having killed her siblings, her and King Triton's siblings, in order to get ahead, and also having had King Triton's wife, Ariel's mother, killed, but blaming it on humans. I don't know. It just kind of seemed to me unnecessary. But I've always loved the adaptation, the stage adaptation, in terms of the new songs that were written by Howard Ashman and Glenn Slater, and almost all of those are still here. All of the good ones, all of the really good ones, specifically this fantastic song called She's in Love and this absolutely beautiful solo for Prince Eric called Her Voice. Those two and several other of the new songs. So I would say that while not still not perfect, that this production is a vast improvement over the Broadway one. And it really bodes well for the future of The Little Mermaid, I think, in, you know, on tour and in regional theater and elsewhere.
A vast improvement indeed. And the thing I always say about this is when I watch the movie of The Little Mermaid just before I saw the stage show some years ago, really, I was so emotionally involved with this character that when she lost her voice, I had to stop watching. I just felt so bad for her.
Oh, wow.
The next night when I went to see the show, I felt nothing. And I can't believe I feel more for an animated character than I do for a human being. And I'm not blaming Sarah Barges for this. I'm really not. I think, as you say, Michael, the direction was really problematic in this show.
Yeah.
Here I felt it for Jessica Grovet. I really did. It's a fascinating first act curtain because at the end of the first act, some people were applauding because she got what she wanted. She's becoming human. She's got her legs. However, at the cost of her voice. So it's very weak applause at the end of the first act because yes, she gets what she wants, no she doesn't, and it's pretty interesting to see that dynamic. I've never seen a first act curtain where you're so torn about a character getting what she ostensibly wants, so I thought that was very interesting as well. Curl Lockhart is always talking to me about the fact that I don't know anything about anything but Broadway, and I mean it really is true that I didn't see the movie until the night before I went to see the stage show, so I came late to this property, and that had its own rewards too, because enough time had passed, and I had heard how wonderful it was. But enough time had passed that it wasn't a case where I was really expecting that I was going to be overwhelmed by the movie and be overwhelmed by the stage show too. I mean, I was able, enough time had passed that I said, well, you know, let's see what happens. So, but yes, this papal version is very, very nice and so many nice performances. Ed Watts, who we saw recently as Superman, is King Triton. And what's so nice about him, he really has a sensitivity. You know, because after all, in Superman, he's playing this two-dimensional character who he has no emotions whatsoever. So we didn't get to see emotions from Ed Watt, but we sure do here. He is such a lovely guy. I mean, yes, he does want what's best for his daughter. Yes, he lays down the law. Yes, as long as you live under my reef, you'll do what I say. I mean, all that stuff. But he's so sensitive, and as he says, I do not want her to fear me. I don't want her to obey me out of fear. I want her to obey me because she knows I'm doing the right thing. So it's very lovely. A lot of human characteristics there. Liz McCartney is terrific as Ursula. Michael, I think she has to do something bad because have done something bad before, because she leads us to believe that Triton just took away what she had. And, you know, there's a wonderful checkmate moment in this show. And that is when Ariel says to her, Chief Arthur says you're terrible, or lies to that effect. She says, well, yeah, but he says humans are terrible and you want to be a human. So,
I mean,
you know, that's a great line. I'm not getting it right. I'm not quoting it. But, I mean, the concept is there, and that's great. Checkmate. Because, you know, how can she argue? You know, she thinks her father's wrong about one thing, so why couldn't he be wrong about another thing? And that could be Ursula, for all she knows. So, so she has to give the benefit of the doubt to Ursula under those circumstances. So that's a very clever thing in this script. So I enjoyed it immeasurably, and the audience was really crazy for it the night I attended. So a good experience at all, and a nice feather in the cap for Paper Mill. This production is going on to a few other places, and I think it'll be warmly received there, too.
Very well directed by Glenn Casale, we should
you bet.
Say. Because especially since the Broadway one, it just was not really that well. And also, briefly, Nick Adams, although I thought he was not 100% perfectly cast in some ways, sang beautifully.
Yeah.
Just very, very beautifully. And to me, yes, Jessica Grovet was wonderful also, but the heart of the show in many ways was a beautiful performance by Alan Mingo Jr. as Sebastian, who really managed to, I mean, it's so easy to become a caricature in that role with this, you know, with the thick Jamaican accent you know, et cetera. But he was, I thought he was very warm and subtle, and you just were with him every moment, and you believed that, you know, how much he cared about her. And he really, I think he has a lot to do with the success of this production.
Well, what's also interesting about that character is that he does get his moment to be sensitive, because he really is two-dimensional for most of the show. But then there's a quartet among, needless to say, the four of them, and he really is very sensitive there. Mm-hmm. And so he really shows us that he's not just coming out with quips. And also, he does show his concern for Ariel. We really get the impression that Ariel loves That he loves Ariel.
Yeah.
That he genuinely loves her. You know, one of the things I always heard about the Nona Nanette revival is that when Rosetta Lenoir came in and came in for Patsy Kelly as the maid, she really brought that dimension to it, that she loved Nanette, that she really cared about her so much. I didn't see her, but I've heard this from a number of people.
I didn't know she took over in that role.
Yeah, I believe she did.
Rosetta Lenoir?
Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I've heard this from a number of people.
No, maybe I'm wrong. I will. That's, we'll both have to look it up.
There I'm goes doing James it right now.
No, I can't right type that you fast. That wasn't me.
So
we'll look it up.
All right, but the suspense is killing me here. But anyway,
I'll look it up while we're doing something else. Let's go on.
So, Peter. After you finished up seeing Little Mermaid, did you take a left-hand turn and head down to Philadelphia to see Night Music?
I did, but I'm looking here and I don't see Rosetta in No Nanette. So maybe maybe it was somebody else. Now I'm interested to see who took over for her. Yes, I did go to Philadelphia to see a Little Night Music. And it took me full circle because I was at the very first performance ever in 1973 at the Colonial Theater in Boston on a January 20th evening, where every human being I knew was who cared about musicals was there. I mean, after Company and Follies, you think we could wait for a second performance? Are you kidding?
Well, so that's the performance, not to interrupt, but Gerard Alessandrini told me he was there too. And one of the most memorable things about it was that, was it before the show or an intermission that Len Carreyrou announced the end of the Vietnam War?
Boy, I don't remember that at all. I must have been out while that was happening.
Oh, wow.
Something like that. I guess it was called Tab then. Anyway, and it's fascinating for me to go back and revisit this piece because I remember where the cut songs were. You know, there's Frid and Petra on the grass, and I'm thinking, well, here's where Silly People was. And all that. Wonderful production. Really quite nice. The Arden Theater in Philadelphia is celebrating its 25th anniversary. Terrence J. Nolan does a wonderful job directing down there. He's one of the two co-founders of the theater. He's still there. And he really has a penchant for Sondheim. I think this is the 13th show he's done, which is quite a few, needless to say. I don't think Sondheim's done all that many more. Very, very simply staged. Certainly our five leader singers do a lot of furniture moving in this one, so that happens a good deal. Madame Armfelt seemed healthy as a horse to me, I will admit, and she's going to die by the end of the show. I hope that's not spoiling anything for anybody. You know, I thought, geez, she's a little healthy. But, you know, everybody, there are people who, after all, do, I just saw him yesterday. He looked so good. What happened? You know, so you can look at it that way. Grace Gongulewski, strange name, but I'm telling you, I've seen her for a lot of years at Arden. She's an important building block on why they've lost to 25 years, plays Desiree. And while I didn't think she was particularly Swedish, she did have the attitude of somebody who was a minor star but had learned along the way that when you meet people, if you act as if you're a great star, you can convince them that you are a great star. And that was something that was really worthwhile as well. Ben Dibble, who's a very important performer down there too, played Carl Magnus and did a marvelous job as this cocksure guy. And the little girl played Frederica, by the way, I thought was really good too, in the sense that I don't mean to hurt feelings, but she's going through an awkward stage in her real life. You know, we all go through these awkward stages. I hope mine passes soon. And so she. They use that, you know, and I thought it was great. You know, yeah, why not cast somebody who's this awkward teenager? So the gentleman played Frederick, a good actor, very good actor, terrific, no question about that. And his name is Christopher Patrick Mullen. Not so good a singer, but finessed his way through by talking the songs. But the revelation to me was Patty Lee Marengo, who played Anne, because... Whoa, this was a lady who really enjoyed controlling men. She was like a spoiled child who ran the house. You know, the children like that. If you spoil your child, suddenly, you know, you're working for the kid. You know, she really had that power. And one of the things you could really see that she was petrified of once Desiree came into their life was the fact that she would lose that power. Not the man, the power. And I've never seen So Forceful an Anne. Now, this could run into trouble because, of course, what happens before the show ends, another spoiler alert here, is, of course, that she runs off with Henrik, Frederick's son. And the thing is, you know, you can't be too strong because then we worry about poor Henrik. He's saddled with this terrible shrew. But she was able to really control that and not cross the line where she really became a bitch. So, but it really was somebody who was really enjoying a power that she never knew she had before and suddenly was making the most of it. So a very successful production, really. Simply done, of course, very little scenery, beautiful costumes, which you really need if you're going to be in the turn of the century Sweden. So, a good experience all around. It's there till the end of the month, and you know, anybody who's never seen that music or has only seen that movie, by all means, this is a good chance to see it.
All right. So, Little Night Music in Philadelphia, and it's Arden Theater Company. Is that the one?
Yep.
Great. Excellent. We'll put a link to that in the show notes and take care of that. Let's swap over from Philadelphia and just head a little bit south where Michael just returned from D.C. where he was at Company. And aside from onstage, Michael, something little happened offstage. Tell us about that. Michael?
Yes. I'm sorry. I was muted. Yes, we got to the theater, and one of the hooks of this production is that three of the married couples in the show are played by three actual married couples who are well known in DC theater. But we get to the matinee on yesterday, Saturday, and there was a sign up that Sherry Edlin and Thomas Adrian Simpson would not appear as Joanne and Larry, but it would be their understudies instead. And we were like, what's that all about? So the show started with the understudies, and then we gradually noticed about halfway through Act One that Joanne and Larry were two different people, and presumably the actual Sherry Edlin and Thomas Adrian Simpson. So at intermission, I went to the front desk and I asked what happened, and they said that there had been a terrible car accident somewhere in D.C., fortunately not involving these two people, but they had been delayed, and so they put on their understudies and they did the first couple of scenes, and then, you know, until Sherry and Thomas got there. But the thing is that, I mean, we were given no explanation. There was an announcement that it wouldn't be them, but we weren't told why. So, you know, we were assuming all kinds of things. But then there they were. And I can safely say that's the first time I've ever seen that happen. I think it's also the first time I personally have ever seen a mid-show substitution. It has happened It has happened in the past. It tends to happen in operas. Yeah, because operas are very long, and sure. if a person is even slightly ill, they might start singing and then realize that they can't go any further. But in those cases, it's always the opposite, that one person starts and then someone else is. The person who's supposed to do it starts the performance, and then the understudy finishes. So this was the opposite.
It happened to me at Pirate Queen, by the way. The night I saw Pirate Queen, Stephanie Block couldn't even finish the first act. So, and in fact, the young woman who supplanted her, it wasn't even until intermission that they made an announcement that she had. So only those with the keenest of eyes, which didn't include me, noticed that we weren't seeing Stephanie Block anymore.
And I've heard that I believe that Harvey Fierstein missed exactly one half a performance of Hairspray. and one night he just was not, you know, he was not really feeling well, and he tried to power through it. But he did, I believe, Act One, and then somebody else did.
Which is interesting, because didn't he have those 8x10 photos on the wall of the entire cast? And if you missed a performance, you took the picture down. His forehead up there, you know, so who knows? Anyway, go on. I'm sorry.
No, that's right. Yeah, I was wondering, too, if maybe he just ripped his picture in half or something. but anyway, I'm happy to say this was quite an excellent production of Company. I could say a lot about it, but just briefly, Matthew Scott, who you may have seen in a couple of shows here in New York, specifically Sondheim on Sondheim. I think that was his only Broadway credit thus far. But he was really terrific as Bobby. Bobby in Company is frequently called a cipher, you know, more of a construct than a character. Mm-hmm. And to a large extent, that's very true. It's just the way the show is written. But he seemed more of a flesh and blood person than anyone I have seen.
Wow, that's great.
Yes, in the role. And that was, you know, partly a choice to do it that way. I mean, I think, you know, I think many people have made the choice to go with the kind of reactive cipher kind of thing. And, you know, I've seen every Bobby I've seen has been great. Don't get me wrong. Raul Esparza, John Barrowman. I saw Davis Gaines do it. Seen several other productions. But Matthew really played him as a, you know, very much a complicated human being. And actually, some of the decisions I didn't agree with, there was one thing that was done that may have been a directorial decision. In the opening number, there were a few moments where Matthew Scott's Bobby was very clearly feeling kind of trapped and almost, you know, maybe trapped, annoyed, and maybe a little angered by all of this, you know, being besieged by all of these married couples. And to me, I really think the opening number is a little too soon. I mean, I think that's kind of playing the end at the beginning. But on the other hand, one very interesting moment is the scene where Kathy, one of his girlfriends, tells him that she's leaving the city to Cape Cod, I believe. And he and Matthew Scott was the one person I've seen who played that scene. He reacted with, he got very hurt and very angry at her. And I had never seen that before.
No,
and
it I haven't
was,
either.
It was really very interesting. Now, one might also argue that maybe it's a little too soon for him to do that, but I have to say it was very effective. Mm-hmm. And actually that kind of gave more of an impetus, I think, you know, more of a setup for Marry Me a Little, which was in fact performed at the end of Act One in this production. They also reinstated not all but half of the TikTok dance for Kathy, which I guess I love it because I love the music so much. The Sondheim melodies as arranged by David Shire and orchestrated by Jonathan Tunick. It's a high point. And even though this production only had about eight, nine, ten people at most in the orchestra, the reduction, which I guess must be Tunick's own reduction for maybe the roundabout, I'm assuming, was so well done that it still sounded really quite beautiful. So I really applaud this production despite that thing I mentioned. Also, this is another production of Company that makes no decision as to what the time period is. Mm-hmm. And I personally think that's a mistake. I think what you have to do is set it in 1970, which doesn't necessarily mean that you have to go overboard and have the men in all these crazy hairstyles and bell bottoms and things like that. Yeah, yeah. I really think that's the way because there's so many things, you know, the busy signals, the lack of cell phones.
My service will explain. Yeah,
right. The very fact that, and it's funny because they make a point about it, but the fact that Joanne is smoking in this nightclub that they're in.
Oh, good point. Yeah,
just can't do it anymore. Right. And even though she makes a lot about that, you know, that's a great scene. But I think that is the thing to do with Company. And Eric Schaefer, who directed this production, did not make a definite decision on that. But in many other ways, this is really a really terrific production.
What's also funky about the thing that's stated in Company is the talk about having the male roommate. And it seems like so bizarre a thing that a man and a woman should live together and share an apartment. It's really put out there in that way. You know, can you imagine? My God, aren't we cosmopolitan that we're living together? You know, and of course, the city is now flooded with male-female roommates and nobody gives a thought to it. But it was a strange and innovative thing back in 1970.
And speaking of male roommates, this production also includes the quote unquote gay scene, mm-hmm. which I think is part of the established script now. And I'd be interested in your thoughts, Peter. I've always had mixed feelings, but I decided that I don't like it. And the main reason I don't like it is because if you do it, it comes right before the penultimate scene with Joanne and Bobby, where she seduces him or tries to seduce him, whether in earnest or not is up to the audience's, you know, interpretation. But if you do the gay scene, quote unquote, it happens right before that, and so you have two scenes in a row where someone is trying to, you know, come on to Bobby and make it with him, and I think it lessens the shock of Joanne doing so.
That's a very good observation, Michael. I think maybe they should have done it the other way around, because while being seduced or attempted to be seduced by your friend whom you've known for a long time. And by the way, when Barbara Walsh did it in that recent revival, there was no doubt what was on her mind. But anyway, you know, really, as shocking as that can be, there's no question that his being approached sexually by a male friend of his trumps that. You're right about that. I agree with that. That never occurred to me, but you're quite right.
Well, yeah, because it's like, you know, if Joanne is the first one to like come out and try to seduce him, I mean, it's a shock for him and the audience.
Yep. You know?
But if we just seen this friend try to do it, it's almost like, oh, okay, somebody else is trying to get in his pants, you know. Mm-hmm, so I think I think it's a mistake. I really do.
I do understand they're wanting to establish the fact that Bobby isn't gay, because that was said so much during the period when it first came out, no pun intended, because people were wondering, well, I mean, he's 35, you know, he hasn't committed. Is this the reason? Does he have this secret life? So at least this addresses the issue. Of course, it doesn't prove anything.
It doesn't prove anything. It
doesn't prove a thing.
Because he also says that he's had a homosexual
right? Yes,
experience.
He does.
And
yes,
I guess it depends on partly on how the actor plays it, but even if he really rejects the advance of which husband is it, Peter?
Yeah,
Dave, Peter. Right. You know, that also doesn't necessarily mean he's not gay. So
absolutely true.
I just don't think so.
Back in the beginning of the internet, like we're talking about, oh, I think 1994 or so, 1993, when you know, some of the general population was coming on. There was a what's called a news group, which is like sort of like a mailing list called Rec Arts Theater, and it became Rec Arts Theater Musicals. And this was one of the most passionately discussed subjects: was is Bobby gay? And I went on for hundreds, if not thousands, of replies, people back and forth, and it still has never been solved.
As I've always said, I'm sorry that people waste so much time on that, in my opinion, because if he's gay, then it's a one-joke show. I mean, isn't that true? If he's gay, then what are we spending 2.5 hours?
Yeah,
you know?
That's fair.
No, but if he's straight and he can't commit to a woman because he just can't commit for 1,000 reasons, then you have a show, I think.
Mm-hmm. It was also very effective that first night in Boston to see Happily Ever After in the spot of being alive, because, I mean, there's no question that being alive is the exact opposite of Happily Never After and Ever After, sorry. And, it really made the point even stronger. It really is a stronger show with Happily Ever After, but it's not a more commercial show with Happily Ever After.
By the way, I noticed, Peter, I'd be interested in your thoughts. I think I noticed a flaw in the lyrics this time for the first time, and like the thousandth time it's
sure,
in company.
Right. Yeah, right.
And it's just one word, but he sings in Someone Is Waiting, Bobby sings, my blue-eyed Sarah, warm Joanne, sweet Jenny, loving Susan, crazy Amy. Now, what's wrong with that?
You tell me. I'm impressed that you did it so well.
Oh, thank you.
What's wrong?
Well, is Joanne warm?
Oh, I see.
I mean, you know, yeah. I guess he could not think of another one-syllable word. But if there's one thing she's not, I mean, she may be hilarious, but she's very cutting. She's very acerbic. She's very
yeah.
So
and we've already heard her do the little things you do together. So as a result, of, you know, it's not even that we're only going to judge her by the scene we see
right.
her later. You
yeah,
know, we've already seen her. I've done it 3 or 4 times. You know,
and
I
we've
mean,
also
so.
Seen her be nasty to. Which one is it, Jenny or someone in the first scene? So I guess that was just a, you know, a tiny little flaw.
Well, that's a good point. Good point.
All right. Well, let's move on. So you were at the signature and you spun around and went over to the Kennedy Center and saw the guardsman, Michael. Tell us about that.
Well, I'll be brief. I was very disappointed. This is a Richard Nelson. It's actually called a new translation. I'm not sure if that's the correct word. I would say a new adaptation. But, I mean, I don't think he necessarily speaks whatever that language is, Hungarian. This was written by Ferenc Molnár, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, who many of us know as the author of Lilium, on which Carousel is based. But Nelson claims to have read this play in the original language and discovered what he says is a play that he didn't know existed before, because The Guardsman is most famous in an English translation as a vehicle for the Lunts on stage and then in film. It's the one film that they made together, and it's a really interesting play, usually played as a complete comedy about an actor and actress who are not married very long, but they're already having problems, mostly because the husband, the actor, is convinced that the actress is being or will be unfaithful to him because she supposedly has a history of that before they were married, of kind of going around with, you know, various men. So anyway, he gets himself up in this outrageous costume as this guardsman, you know, complete with a really thick accent and all this hair and a mustache and blah blah blah, and he pretends to be this guardsman and woos the wife and you know, tries to seduce her, and then only belatedly does he reveal that he's actually himself. And one of the questions is, you know, whether the wife knew it all along or
right.
not. And it's a very complex play, even if you play it as a complete comedy, which is, you know, I have never actually seen it. Have you, Peter?
No, I've seen a musical version called Enter the Guardsman, and I've
right.
seen the movie version of The Chocolate Soldier, which seems like it would have nothing to do with The Guardsman, but it is The Guardsman. They took all of the songs of The Chocolate Soldier, but inserted them into the plot of The Guardsman. I swear this is true. But I've never seen it on stage.
Well, anyway, this is a very, very dark production. It opens with the two of them on stage, you know, with also with this friend of theirs called The Critic. And I should say, by the way, the actor is played by Finn Wittrock, who got amazingly wonderful reviews as for his performance as Happy in the revival of Death of a Salesman with Philip Seymour Hoffman. And the actress is played by Sarah Wayne Callies. And the critic, the critic, their friend, is played by Shula Hensley. And the actress's confidant, whom she calls Mother, is played by Julie Halston. So this is quite, you know, and directed by Gregory Mosher. And therein lies, you know, part of the issue here, because Richard Nelson has made a big point of making this play very, very dark, as he insisted it is in the original version, in the original Molnár version. And I can't argue with him because I've never read that. So we'll have to take him at his word. But all I can say is, you know, adapted, translated by Richard Nelson and directed by Gregory Mosher, who is not really known for light comedy, it really did not work at all. The first act was absolutely deadly and very, very dark and very, very sad. You felt like these people were in pain, you know. Whereas I thought the first act should have been played more as if they were something like, you know, Fred and Lily and Kiss Me, Kate, where, you know, it's more of a comic disagreement, you know, with each other, you know, kind of not being able to live with each other, but not being able to live without each other either. But that's not what was here at all. So I'm going to have to try to see the movie and or read the original version somehow, and make my judgment based on that. But just in terms of what I saw and the audience reaction that I could very well sense and hear comments at intermission was really negative. After Act One, as my companion put it, the play kicked in, and there was nothing that could be done to really kind of sabotage it. But the beginning and also the very ending, it just I don't know. I don't see how it could be. I don't see how the laughs could be what they're supposed to be if the rest of it is played so dark and so real. So I'm not convinced by this version whatsoever, although I must say I believe it got some very good reviews, so whatever that's worth.
All right, so we'll turn around and head back north to New York. And coming home, Peter tried to see a Tennessee Williams play. Which one was it, Peter?
The two-character play, which is at New World Stages, or is it? This is really turning out to be a bit of a problem because this past week, three performances were canceled. I was supposed to go yesterday afternoon. I was told by the press agent, no, don't come. So I don't know what's going on there. I don't know if there's a problem with Brad Dourif. I don't know if there's a problem with Amanda Plummer. I don't know if there's a problem completely unrelated to both of them. You know, I don't know if it's a financial issue. If checks are bouncing, you know, who knows? But whatever the case may be, let's keep an eye on that because people should know that if they're planning to go see this show in this upcoming week, maybe a phone call to the box office is in order before you head out from home.
Peter, did they not give you any reason?
There was no reason given, no, just that the performance was canceled.
Wow.
No, it wasn't like due to injury, due to illness. Yeah. No, just canceled. So I don't know.
That's always tough because with a schedule like yours, you know, it's not so easy to just pick up and go see another performance because you have other things scheduled. And
sure, but they may have many bigger problems than I do here. And I'm not laughing at their problems. I'm laughing because the thought of the fact that it inconvenienced me is far less of an issue than the fact that something's having a problem over there. This, by the way, for the record, was a play that was done on Broadway in the 70s under the title Outcry. I guess, I mean, maybe he rewrote it substantially, but it certainly, at the very least, is based on Outcry. It may be word for word or it's a revisal. I have no idea. But nevertheless, it is that show about a brother and sister who may be crazy and may be incestuous and may be a lot of things. So we'll see how it plays out. If they resume performances, we'll see.
All right. Michael got a chance to see the last two offerings out at Gay Fest. And Michael, why don't you tell us about those quickly?
Yes, I will. I'm sorry I missed the first one, which Peter saw and loved, Moonlight and Magnolias. The second one was called The Loves of Mr. Lincoln by David Brendan Hopes. And it's about largely about Lincoln's relationship with Joshua Speed, of which I'm sure many of us have read, you know, especially in recent years, this fellow with whom Lincoln was very, very close for decades. And, you know, question as to whether they were anything approaching like what we would consider gay lovers today. You know, it's so hard to answer that because times were so different then, and people looked at relationships differently, and there was no concept of gay as we think of it today, literally.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
But anyway, so it was a very interesting play that had a lot of good in it. This is the play of all the plays that I've ever seen in my life that I think could have used a dramaturg. It was this one because there was a lot of good in it, but there was too much good in it. It was three hours long with the intermission, and it just seemed like a lot of it a lot of it covered the same ground over and over again. So I wish, you know, I hope Mr. Hopes doesn't consider this a finished product, because I think he really has something there, but he really needs to bring to do it himself or bring someone in to help him to cut this down.
Does the play reach a conclusion that indeed they were lovers?
Well, no, I mean, you don't see, you don't really see them. You see them being physical with each other, but not to any, you know, deep extent. Mm-hmm. It doesn't reach a conclusion as to whether they had sex with each other, I would say.
That's what I'm asking.
Or if it does, I missed it. But it's certainly not depicted. But they do sleep together, which is a matter of historical record. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it gets kind of, it can be a very fine line, can't it? Mm-hmm. Good production, good actors. Speed was Stacey Todd Holt. Lincoln was Stephen Hawke, who has been in lots of things. Mary Todd Lincoln, who has a very major role, was Leah Kearney. You know, as I say, a lot of good stuff there, but you know, maybe too much of a good thing. And the last show that the Gay Fest brought us was a revival of Gross Indecency, The Three Trials of Oscar Wilde, here billed as being by Moises Kaufman, although I'm pretty sure I remember that the original production was being was billed as being by Moises Kaufman and the members of the Tectonic Theater Project, because it was one of those plays that was kind of put together by committee based on transcripts of the original Wilde trials and also interviews with people of the time and also contemporary scholars. Whatever it is, you know, whoever wrote it, it's really quite a gripping, wonderful, fantastic play, and it was great to see it again. I guess it's the third time I've seen it. I saw a production in LA that was quite wonderful, and this one was notable for having an extremely young cast. The oldest one in it, presumably, was the fellow who played Wilde, Joshua Forkham, and he looked like at very most 30. But a lot of the other ones, many of them seem to have come out of NYU very recently. So we're talking about, you know, people barely out of their teens, and maybe some of them still in it. That brought a whole new energy to it, and it was done in a very physical theater way. There was, like, you know, tugs of war happening on stage and things like that. There was also some choreography, which I didn't think was very effective. People pounding the floors at certain points, which I didn't like because it obscured some of the dialogue. But overall, really, really quite well done. The director is Zi, is his first name. So Zi, I don't know. Last name is Ali Khan. I really appreciated the chance to see the play again, because it really was quite extraordinary, the original production. It launched the career of Michael Emerson, who has gone on to some really great things in theater and television, I might add.
This play came out of nowhere, because it was simply being done as a showcase, but the press agent, Kevin McInerney, was just so entranced with it. He called up critics and said, look, I never do this for a showcase. If I'm doing it for this one, there must be something to it. You must come to this. You must come to this. And he would not let up, and indeed helped launch, as you say, Michael Emerson's career, but certainly Mr. Kaufman's career. Certainly. By the way, Michael, my recollection is this was one where he did it not with Tectonic. That doesn't mean I'm right. I believe Tectonic was involved, but not necessarily as writers, though, of course, who knows what really happened behind the scenes.
Oh.
But I believe the credit only went to Moises Kaufman as the playwright in this one. Everything else seems to have been Tectonic.
All right. Well, that's another thing we're going to have to look up along.
Yeah, with, yeah. You know, I mean, I'm not saying I'm right. This is what I remember. But no, anyway, what I certainly remember is Kevin McInerney was an important building block in that play's success, and I don't believe it would have happened without him.
Yes, and I remember distinctly that him, Kevin, prevailing on me to
me too.
And I'm so glad I did. And another thing they launched, I think they can take credit to some extent for helping to launch the Barrow Street Theater as a theater place, because I think that was certainly one of the first shows of any note that played there. Mm-hmm. So that's yet another thing that launched.
But it's also astonishing that a play of this scope can go to the Minetta Lane Theater and run well over a year. I mean, that's pretty impressive, because this is not, you know, a slam bag audience pleaser. It's not a comedy. I mean, it's about a very serious subject, and it was damn good, and I'm very glad that Gay Fest did it.
All righty. So there it is. And the Gay Fest is running through June 16th, so it's ending today. So I hope that anybody who was interested had gotten out to see it. Peter had talked about it very very favorably a few weeks back, and hopefully you've all caught up on your podcasts to catch this before it has closed. So anything else you guys want to chat about before we wrap up here?
I just had a quick funny story from Provincetown, where I was a few weeks ago. Elizabeth Ashley was was the guest of honor at this fundraiser for the Provincetown Tennessee Williams Festival. And we were talking, and she was talking to someone else about Lee Strasberg. And I didn't hear the beginning of it, so I'm not sure if she was talking about an audition for Strasberg or maybe a scene that she did in class. But she said at one point, and then Lee turned to me and he said, "Darling, you know what? I need a little more Rita Hayworth and a little less Stanislavski." So I thought that was typical Elizabeth Ashley. And by the way, here's a scoop. For people around here, it's gotten some publicity up in Provincetown and the Cape, but the actual Tennessee Williams Festival happens at the end of September, and it's going to feature, among other things, a production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with Keir DeLay as Big Daddy. And his wife, Maya Dillon, as Big Mama.
How funny. I saw Keir DeLay play Brick back in the 70s at the Kennedy Center.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And Liz Ashley herself has gone from playing Maggie in that production with Keir DeLay to playing Big Mama in I'm not sure. She's done it at least once. I think it's great when actors. I really think it's
I love that too. Love that too. I don't think Rosanna Lenoir played either part, though. I don't believe that. But
Martha Ray. I looked it up. Martha Ray was.
Is that right?
Yes, and then also a woman whose name I didn't recognize, Patricia Donnelly.
Yeah, that's Rosetta Lenoir's stage name. Yeah, that's she did under an assumed name. So anyway, oh well. Thank you, James.
Alrighty, so I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically added to iTunes for you. That way, you won't miss anything. If, in fact, you want to listen to us in another way, you can listen to us on the Stitcher app. That's for your iPhone, your iPad, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and listen to us streaming. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you have made it this far into it, last week we talked about the giveaway for the Tony Award Playbill, and my goodness, about 2 hours or maybe 3 hours after we had posted the podcast, we had 50-plus requests for it, and it ended up over the course of the week being over 200 requests for the playbill. So wow. I'm sorry that so many people got shortchanged on that. We'll try to make it better by offering a free giveaway this week. Giveaway the first three people who go to our Facebook page, which is Broadway Radio on Facebook, and like us on Facebook, we'll give the first three folks there a double CD of Giant, which has been donated to us to give to you guys. Okay. So if you want to do that, please check it out. Get a copy of Giant for yourself. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Heartbreak country that they call her, land below and sky above. In my blood I've got this country, memories of those before me, and to honor those before me. Heartbreak country, my love.
In our child,
the past and future,
things will change.
But in our hearts, this heartbreak country will be.